Step into Zell's Dimension, the podcast where music, creativity, and curiosity meet the mysteries of the universe. Each episode explores thought-provoking realms of alternative theories, ancient history, cosmic phenomena, and the hidden connection between music, frequencies, art, and the unexplained. If you're a deep thinker, a stargazer, a creator, or someone who craves conversations beyond the ordinary, this is your portal. Zell's Dimension, where reality bends and imagination thrives.
Welcome to Zombie Strange, the podcast where we watch all the zombie movies in order. This week, three titans of horror cinema, Vincent Price, Roger Corman, and Richard Matheson in 1962's Tales of Terror.
You know, I've seen people act like that in pictures. What do they call them, zombies or something?
Zombies.
What's a zombie?
Just what is a zombie?
Well, a zombie, there's Mr. Bill.
The living dead.
They are the living dead.
Get into zombies.
He's a zombie.
Because a zombie has no will of his own.
It's an army of zombies. No armies could stand.
What is wrong? What is wrong?
Hey, everybody. Welcome to our podcast. I'm John.
I'm Andy.
I'm Brad.
Hey, guys. We had a trilogy of terror this week, and I found it kind of delightful.
Yes, indeed.
Was this movie... This wasn't colorized. I think this was in color.
In color.
And it seems like... I mean, it's not like a... You know, like a Mercedes here, but it's a decent production, you know.
Yeah, Roger Corman has a reputation for making trashy, schlocky stuff, but honestly... From where we have been in this podcast, you guys, this felt like a masterpiece, I know. Honestly.
Yeah. I know. It felt like total mainstream, big budget. I know there's movies out there that like that are not terrible that we should be watching.
Yeah. What if we watched a really good movie from like the 50s or 60s, guys? What do you think that would do to our brains?
I don't know, but I'm looking at the list of 1962 movies that producer Brad has listed for us. I will let him list them off, but... There's like, I've seen...
Go ahead.
We've got Lawrence of Arabia, To Kill a Mockingbird, The Manchurian Candidate, Stanley Kubrick's Lolita, Dr. No, Mutiny on the Bounty, and a movie that I love, which is still in black and white, which is The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, starring Jimmy Stewart, John Wayne, and Jack Palance. So, like, I've seen all of these movies probably more than once.
And now you've seen Tales of Terror.
And now I've seen Vincent Price and Tales of Terror. Yes.
Exactly.
All right. Well, now that we're here, give us the breakdown on this one, Bradley.
All right. Tales of Terror opened on July 4th, 1962, in a double bill with Burn, Witch, Burn, a British film that was not based on the novel Burn, Witch, Burn that we discussed in our The Curse of the Doll People episode. This movie is based on a different novel called Conjure Wife. In Britain, this movie was called Night of the Eagle. The New York Times reviewed both movies, Tales of Terror and Burn, Witch, Burn, and recommended that moviegoers skip Tales of Terror, calling it dull, absurd, and trashy, and instead people should watch Burn, Witch, Burn.
I'm personally offended by that, though I haven't seen Burn, Witch, Burn.
I have read Conjure Wife. Is that by Fritz Lieber?
Yes.
Okay.
Was it a good book?
I think I enjoyed it. It's been a while. He's considered a kind of iconic early fantasy horror writer.
Yeah, and he invented two very famous sort of barbarian figures that I read as a young man, the Farhad and the Grey Mouser.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, what's interesting is we're also getting into the books that we probably started growing up with as Gen Xers.
Yes,
right?
For
like
sure.
Like 60s, 70s, you know, 80s, like those are the books that we started reading. Like though this book is not that old when I started reading. You know what I mean?
Well, the New York Times said of Burn, Witch, Burn that it may be the best outright goose pimpler dealing specifically with witchcraft since I Walked with a Zombie.
Oh, nice.
Ooh, hey,
so that's right. How much they like the movie we didn't watch.
I might need to watch that one on my own.
Also opening this week in 1962 were the following films: Birdman of Alcatraz, The Creation of the Humanoids, Tarzan Goes to India, The Three Stooges in Orbit, and Panic in Year Zero.
So there were some not great films.
The number
in Near Zero, what? Gravity? Temperature? I need some information.
So Panic in Year Zero was directed by Ray Milland. He starred in it with Frankie Avalon. And it's about a family that leaves LA to go camping. And after they leave the city, a hydrogen bomb destroys the city.
Oh,
that's a bummer.
That is not what I would have guessed from the title.
No, I thought it was going to be somebody trapped in a time loop or something.
Yeah, I was thinking, you know, someone trapped in Antarctica or something. Yeah. I don't know.
All right.
The number one film at the box office the week this movie was released was That Touch of Mink, starring Cary Grant and Doris Day, which is in its third week. Tales of Terror did well at the box office, setting records for its distributor, American International Pictures, with $70,000 on the opening day. AIP was an independent producer and distributor of mostly low-budget films targeting teens. Samuel Arkoff, one of the founders of AIP, had a formula that he used to make successful films. It's an acronym of his last name, A-R-K-O-F-F, and it's action, revolution, killing, oratory, fantasy, and fornication.
That's great.
Well played.
Roger Corman produced and directed Tales of Terror. He was an independent producer and director. He produced or directed over 500 movies between 1954 and his death in 2024.
That is bonkers. Can we just take a moment? He directed movies from 1955 to 1990. So that's what? That's 35 years.
No, that's 570 years.
When did he start?
1954 to 2024.
Oh, okay. Still, that's bananas.
Yes, it's a lot. But, you know, he was famous for, if he was shooting somewhere in location, he goes, all right, what can I shoot for another film while I'm here? So he would get the most bang for his buck to make his films cheap, but still look good.
Yes.
The first films he produced were Highway Dragnet, Monster from the Ocean Floor, and The Fast and the Furious.
Okay.
Wait, hit me with that last one again. Wait, hold on.
Is the modern Fast and the Furious, is that a remake of an old film, an old Roger Corman film?
It is not. It is. So they were making the first one and they're trying to come up with a title. And the producer, Neil Moritz, was somehow involved with the documentary on Corman and that era. And he saw that title flash by and he called the studio the next day, said, I have the title. We need to do the Fast and the Furious. And so they called Corman to see if they could use it. And what do you think he said?
He said, if you pay me, you can.
That's not Roger Corman. Roger Corman says, sure, just give me some stock footage I can use in my next film. So they got the license to the title by giving him some stock footage.
That's amazing.
In 1960, Corman directed House of Usher, based on the Edgar Allan Poe short story, The Fall of the House of Usher. Richard Matheson wrote the screenplay. It was a big success and led to the Corman-Poe cycle, 8 movies based on the works of Edgar Allan Poe. Tales of Terror is the third film in the series. Richard Matheson wrote 5 of the Corman Poe movies. He is probably most famous for writing the novel I Am Legend, which was adapted into a movie 3 times. The first was The Last Man on Earth, starring Vincent Price in 1964, then The Omega Man, starring Charlton Heston in 1971, and the last version was I Am Legend in 2007 with Will Smith.
Can we stop and talk about Richard for a second here? Because I'm a huge fan. The novel I Am Legend not only made a huge impact on me, like I found it so compelling, even though it is, you know, it was years old when I read it. And it is he's like a blueprint for modern horror writing in so many ways. He also worked, I think, extensively on The Twilight Zone. He's credited with 16 episodes.
And they are some of the best episodes. So he did Nightmare on 20,000. At 20,000 feet. If there was a really good episode of Twilight Zone that you remember, there's like a 50% chance he wrote it.
Yeah. He set the tone for horror for so long. Like, and also I'm seeing here, he wrote What Dreams May Come in 1998. So like, this is bananas.
It was a novel that was adapted. Yeah. And he also, his novel A Stir of Echoes was adapted in 99.
Yeah, he's not. I mean, he's famous to movie nerds and stuff, but to people who aren't regular movie folks, he may not be as popular a name. But if you have a chance, you should read I Am Legend. I guess that's the last thing I'll say about it. It is a great novel, and none of the movies have done it justice. So,
2 other of his books or his novels were adapted. He did The Shrinking Man, which was adapted into The Incredible Shrinking Man in the 50s. And then in the 70s, he had a book called Bid Time Return, which was adapted into the Christopher Reeve film Somewhere in Time with Jane Seymour.
Oh, that's a good movie, actually.
Yeah, I think he's a great example of someone who is quietly one of the most influential voices in a whole genre across several mediums.
Yeah.
That, like, that is relatively not well known. I mean, people know that novel I Am Legend, but I don't know. I mean, his voice honestly is one of a few that really charted like what we think of as a modern horror story.
And part of it is his stories, at least as in written form, are actually fairly complex and not simple. Like you would think that somebody with this kind of influence would write like simple, bare bones sort of stories. But if you read I Am Legend, it is a complicated, not plot wise, but like emotionally complicated story in so many ways. There's this great moment, like in a modern movie, in any movie, right? The last person alive is going to figure out how to do the science to solve the problem. That's what Will Smith does in I Am Legend. There's a great scene in the book of I Am Legend where he picks up a textbook and he starts looking through it to see if he can figure out what happened. And he just throws it against the wall. He's like, I'm no scientist. You know, so he sort of takes these tropes, establishes them, and then flips them over.
Well, moving on from Richard Matheson, we have Floyd.
Sorry.
That's okay. It's okay. There's a lot of good people to talk about here.
Yeah.
Floyd Crosby was the cinematographer. He won an Oscar for Best Cinematography for his first feature film, Taboo, A Story of the South Seas, in 1931. In the early 50s, he worked on two high-profile films, High Noon in 1952 and From Here to Eternity in 1953. Then in 1954, he worked on one of Roger Corman's first films, Monster from the Ocean Floor, and this led to a long collaboration with Corman. Crosby was the cinematographer on seven of the Corman Poe films.
Oh, all right.
And trivia, his son is David Crosby, the singer-songwriter from The Byrds and Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Sometimes Young.
Nice. Ah.
Les Baxter wrote the score for Tales of Terror. He started his career as a singer and joined Mel Torme's group, Meltones, at the age of 23. In the 50s, he had his own orchestra and had several hits, including a version of Unchained Melody. In the 60s, he started scoring B-movies for American International Pictures. And one of his last films he scored was one you might remember from the 80s on videotape, 1983's The Beast Within.
Oh, yeah. Also, there's a theme in here in the first story that I was like, wait, was that the Jaws theme? It's like so close
to it. It sounded like it, yeah. All right, on to the cast. Now, I'm only going to focus on the last story of the three in the film because there's a lot of meat to talk about here.
Yes.
And we want to talk about the movie, not the actors as much. Vincent Price plays Ernest Valdemar. Price was a character actor, and his first film role was in Service Deluxe, released in 1938. In 1940, he starred as the Invisible Man in The Invisible Man Returns. In 1947, he starred as Simon Templar in the radio program The Saint. He was the third actor to play Templar on radio. In 1953, Price starred in House of Wax, a 3D horror movie and box office hit, which led to more horror roles. The Fly, House on Haunted Hill, and The Tingler.
The Tingler.
And seven of the Corman Poe movies.
I want to say a lot about Vincent Price, but I think I'll do it when we're in the movie.
Most people of our generation know Price from either the Brady Bunch episode in Hawaii or Michael Jackson's Thriller.
Yep.
But he also did a monologue on a 1975 Alice Cooper song. The song was Devil's Food, and it was on Alice Cooper's first solo album, Welcome to My Nightmare. Basil Rathbone plays Dr. Carmichael. He was a veteran of the British Army in World War I and was awarded the Military Cross. He started acting in silent films and successfully transitioned to talkies and became known for playing the villain in movies like The Adventures of Robin Hood, A Tale of Two Cities, and Captain Blood.
But he plays one of the great heroes of all time. That's what he's really known for.
He was best known for playing Sherlock Holmes in 15 Sherlock Holmes films. The first was 1939 in The Hound of the Baskervilles.
Which is not a bad movie if you've ever watched it. It's actually, I enjoyed it very much.
Well, watching this one, so it would be impossible for him not to steal the scene in any movie he's in. Like, he would have to be the villain or the hero. You could never have like a side part. Like, he's just such a screen dominating character.
Yes.
Deborah Padgett plays Helene. She had a few big parts in her early career. She co-starred with Jimmy Stewart in Broken Arrow and played Lilia in The Ten Commandments. In 1956, she and Richard Egan received top billing over Elvis for the film Love Me Tender. It was Elvis's film debut.
There was one of the rumors from that film was that he absolutely adored her and actually proposed marriage at one point.
Elvis?
Yes.
Yeah.
Huh.
Now, in 1959, she starred in the German film The Indian Tomb and performed The Snake Dance, which still gets viewed a lot on YouTube. It's a very risque dance, especially for the 50s, and she's wearing very little. In fact, I think what she is wearing is glued on. I'll post a link in the show notes if anyone wants to see it. She was married three times. Her third husband, Louis Ling Chia Kung, is a descendant of Confucius. And Confucius's family tree is believed to be one of the best documented, with over 2 million people, and probably the oldest tree.
Huh.
Now, Louis's maternal aunt was Sung Mai Ling, better known as Madam Chiang, wife of Chiang Kai-shek, leader of the Republic of China.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
So what this means is her children are descendants of Confucius.
Wow. And also, she's part of the origin story of Taiwan as well, which is interesting.
Yeah. And later in life, she became a born-again Christian and had a show on the Trinity Broadcasting Network. And I could not find a notice of her death, so I think she is still alive today.
According to my very brief research, she's 93 and lives in Boulder, Colorado. So,
there you go.
And you did all that research and you didn't invite her on the show,
John? I know, I'm sorry. And not to throw shade, her first two weddings, her first two marriages, one lasted 4 months and the second one lasted a year, but they only stayed together for 22 days, separated, and then got divorced after a year. So again, no judgment for Deborah.
Right.
But
well, Tales of Terror was a box office success. IMDb lists its receipts as $1.5 million for 1962. Its success ensured more Corman Poe films, and Vincent Price and Deborah Padgett both appeared together in another one, The Haunted Palace. And this time they were joined by Lon Chaney Jr.
All right.
So, John, what happened in the world in 1962?
Well, we've done a couple early 60s episodes, and one of the reasons that Andy and I aren't doing huge historical contexts yet is 1962, you know, John F. Kennedy is still president. Lyndon Baines Johnson is still vice president. The Bay of Pigs has occurred at this point, which is a big historical moment. The space race is on, but what we think of the 60s, and Andy and I will talk about this in more detail in future episodes, hasn't really started yet. You know, like historically, like the world is always in flux. I'm not saying there's like a hard line between the 50s and 60s, but if I were to pick sort of a time where the 60s, as we think of it in the popular imagination, began, it's not until the next year. It's not until John F. Kennedy is assassinated and we get into Vietnam. Once those things happen, then the 60s that is, you know, romanticized about throughout culture, that's when that starts. And it hasn't started yet. So that's, well, more on that soon. Having said that about 60s cinema, about how has it really become the 60s yet, 60s horror cinema has started to evolve. And so Andy's going to talk us through some of the big points of that.
Yeah, so obviously the zombie genre we love is a subgenre of horror, and horror is going through a pretty big metamorphosis right now. So I think the biggest thing to point out about what's going on in horror at the time that this movie came out is that the impact of Psycho is starting to be felt. So in 1960, Psycho comes out, and it created this a massive wave of psychological horror stories and films.
Yes.
And this is a really dramatic move away from the 50s, where, as we saw in this podcast, a lot of the dangers and the threats and the horrors are external things like aliens and monsters and robots and things like that. But after Psycho, films and horror in general started getting a lot more interested in internal human horror. So like we think of that cliche that, you know, humans are the real monsters. That was an obsession of this decade. And so,
and even if a movie is about an external force, the narrative tends to be told through the inner turmoil of the character. So this is much later, but like Rosemary's Baby, for example,
yes,
is about something exactly external, but the whole thing is told through Rosemary's point of view all the time. And
yeah,
and that's a big change from these external threats and external viewpoints.
Yeah. So in the 60s, we have this turn to psychological, internal, and melodramatic horror. So you can see why Edgar Allan Poe's stories would be like the perfect fit to make movies of at this time, because they are all about that, the melodrama, the horror. So there's this trend of melodramatic horror in the 60s that it's going to eventually lose out to a parallel trend of more gritty and realistic horror. And so by like the late 60s, that type of horror will be taking over from the melodrama stuff we're watching right now. But right now, melodrama is king. And this means movies with like really high emotional stakes.
Yeah, this is a gothic story with big, yeah, sprawling, dark emotions all over it. Yeah.
Dark family secrets are a big, mm-hmm, part of this. You're starting to see the incorporation of like a character's past trauma as a source of horror, maybe the entirety of the horror, and also really theatrical, like over the top performances, which we definitely saw in this movie,
which we get several of in this film.
Yes. And so this is the golden age of a sort of gothic horror, like kind of a gothic horror revival. And so it's not a surprise. This is the age of the Hammer films, and it makes total sense that this is the age of Roger Corman's Edgar Allan Poe stories, which hit all of those buttons, right?
Yeah, and you know, two thoughts about that. So you said there's a parallel track of gritty horror that eventually wins. Spoiler, one of the films that pushes that to the top is going to be Night of the Living Dead, which is it has some melodrama in it, but it is a dark, gritty, realistic movie in a way that this movie is not. So
there's one little sub point I want to make, although it's not related to this particular film. So in the 60s, in 1962 specifically, this year, we see the creation of a weird little subgenre of horror genre.
Yeah.
It's the, have you heard the term the psycho biddy subgenre?
I've heard that term, but I've never heard it applied to film. So tell me what
this is. This is a whole subgenre of horror centered around a formerly glamorous woman who in her old age has become unstable and dangerous and psychotic.
Oh, interesting.
And so in 1962, ground zero, year zero for this is Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, the movie, which created this genre. And then it's going to go on. There's movies like Straight Jacket and Hush Hush, Sweet Charlotte. And these aren't small movies. They have big names like Betty Davis, Joan Crawford, Olivia de Havilland, and other big names. This genre is going to mostly come and go within about like 8 or 10 years.
But these films are really memorable.
They are.
Yeah.
I was going to say, though, John, but just this year, I saw revived in the year of our Lord 2025. I saw revived conversation about this genre around what movie this year do you think might have triggered a revived discussion about this genre, which is sometimes called hagsploitation.
I would say that movie would have to be Weapons.
It was Weapons, yes. So the genre is kind of long past its golden age, but it's clearly a horror trope that it occasionally still pops to the surface. So
as modern and fresh as Weapons is, it leans on some old tried and true tropes. One is the hag. The other is this sort of ritual voodoo style magic. You know, those are as old as the movies we're watching here. So
yes.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. So that's all I got. I mean, the thing to take away from this is that this film, Tales of Terror, is very, very, very firmly planted in that melodrama, gothic, psychological terror thing that is having an absolute heyday right now in the early 60s. All right, that's what I got.
Well, let's summarize these movies. Right. So if we haven't made it clear, this movie is an anthology movie. There's three different stories. Each of them stars Vincent Price in the lead role, but they're three different Edgar Allan Poe stories. So we're going to go through the first two kind of briefly because it doesn't have the zombie content that we want. And it's really the third one that does. So we'll do a brief summary and then just say a few things about the first two. And then we'll get into more detail on the third one. So do you want to kick us off, Andy?
Yeah. So this first little piece in this anthology movie, and each of these is based on an Edgar Allan Poe story. Sometimes taking some pretty big liberties with it, but usually in an entertaining way. So this first one is the most straightforwardly gothic of the three stories we're going to watch today. And it tells a story of a young woman named Lenora, which is a very Edgar Allan Poe name, right? Showing up at a crumbling, decrepit manor on a rocky seashore. It's a dark and stormy night outside. And she helps herself into this manor, which is just falling apart. It's full of cobwebs. Whoever was assigned to make the cobwebs just went
Yeah, they
crazy.
Were given a free hand with the cobwebs. They're like sheets. They yes. look like sheets with some holes in them because so much cobwebs.
So the gist of this one is, though, that this is Lenora is here to visit her father one last time. Lenora is dying. She doesn't have long to live, and she has lived a sort of a difficult life. And she is here to maybe make amends with her father, who has hated and rejected her all her life because her father's wife died shortly after giving birth to Lenora. And her father blamed Lenora for killing his love. And even more depressing, the mother seemed to blame Lenora for yes. her own death. She is portrayed as a cruel and angry woman. But at any rate, so after decades, Lenora and her father kind of confront each other. The father admits that, yes, I blamed you for my wife's death. And they are maybe on the cusp of something like a reconciliation now that they are both, the father is old and probably not too far from death, and she has some sort of unspecified illness. They're maybe about to reconcile when the ghost of the mother, named Morella, unfortunately revives, possesses Lenora, strangles the father, and then in the course of that conflict, the mansion is set on fire and this whole cursed family burns to yes. dust. So what do you say, John? So that's the overview. We're not going to spend very much time on this because there's no zombies in this, although there is a zombie
adjacent
thing.
I was going to say, it's zombie. It has a moment.
We'll talk about. So, John, tell me something that struck you about this.
So the most interesting thing is that a couple of things. One is that Vincent Price's character lives in one room, and it's the only halfway clean room, and the rest of the house is absolutely covered in cobwebs to a ridiculous degree. That was ridiculous. Yes. Now, additionally, you didn't say it in the summary, but it's key, is that he has kept his wife's body, and she has become mummified and just lies yeah. in a bed in one of the rooms.
Her corpse looks great,
Her corpse
by the
should
way.
Be a zombie in a zombie movie. Yes. But they get rid of it. By the time it's sort of got to animate a little bit, they've changed the look, which is unfortunate. But yes.
Yeah, for sure. So not a lot happens in this. This is, it's really kind of a long conversation. And then it culminates with about 3 minutes of horror as the mother revives and wreaks this havoc.
Yes.
I wanted to say this. You can laugh at me. I did not realize until this was done that the father was Vincent Price.
And I will laugh at you.
I don't know why. I think I figured out what it was by the time I got to the next couple movies in this stories in this anthology, which all feature Vincent Price. And so I know Vincent Price from being the host of Mystery in the 1980s, mm-hmm. the PBS mystery show. And I was not expecting that he would already look really old in 1962.
I know. When was he the Invisible Man, producer Brad? Was that 1941?
His version, I think, was 40.
So I guess he's 20 years into his career. But I just have this feeling that he's someone that looked like an old person at like age 25.
Yeah.
Like that's just
I
the
think
sense
so. I think I get that sense.
Yeah. Just to give you a little bit of the flavor of this whole anthology film, I do want to play an audio clip because each of these films opens with a voiceover by Vincent Price. And they just the tone in which he delivers them really sets the spirit for these movies. So let's hear the opening introductory audio for Morella.
This is the beat of a human heart. Sit very still and listen. Is your heart beating in this same rhythm? You are experiencing the heartbeat of a dying man. And it is with death and dying that we concern ourselves. What happens at the point of death? What happens afterwards?
You know what? It took me a while. You know what I figured out about Vincent Price's voice? It's the same thing as Boris Karloff's voice. When they're not being scary or a bit dramatic, it's incredibly soothing.
Yes. I could listen to that all day on loop. Like, what a voice that guy has. It's
and it's
incredible.
Reassuring and soothing. And that's part of what makes it so creepy and makes him so good as a narrator. It's like contrasting, contrasting effects that come together really well. So, yes, that voice is like...
If I was in the theater in 1962 and the movie started like this, I would be happy from that moment on that I was getting what I paid for.
Absolutely, yes. Right? Because it is creepy, but it's that weird dichotomy of creepy versus reassuring.
So I want to ask to hear one other audio clip just because I thought it was cool. And this is where Lorena and her father, Vincent Price, are kind of... this is where she reveals that she is also, despite being quite young, after a hard life... She is now close to death. So let's hear them talking about that.
She was so young, so alive. To die just a few months after giving birth to you, she couldn't accept it. I hated you. Oh, dear God, how I hated you. I wanted to kill you. I went into your nursery and I took you out of your cradle and I almost hurled you out of the window.
I wish you had.
What? You're ill.
I have a few months left to live. We're both dead now, Father.
I just love it. I'm sorry. The only other one thing I wanted to say is like we have a truly nasty ghost in this one. She is like if you're hoping for like that there will be some sort of reconciliation, that the mother will apologize for her cruel behavior in life, we do not get it. And the final shot of this clip is the corpse grinning as the house burns down around her dead husband and daughter. It's
And I will say the almost more gruesome thing is the wife steals the life energy of the daughter to reanimate and puts the daughter in her place as a sort of decomposing corpse. And then she comes in to see Vincent Price. And that's creepy on so many levels. I don't even know why. Yes. I don't even want to dig into them all. But yeah.
So the last thing I'll say here is if it's not clear by now. So this is what I am here
yes.
for. Like, so I know that Roger Corman, so I went into this thinking Roger Corman, he's known for terrible schlocky crap, right? That's what you'll hear. But you know what? I just inject this straight into my veins because this is what I'm here for. These are like basically three great episodes of like Tales from the Crypt or Twilight Zone or whatever, but I love it. I have almost nothing bad to say about any of these three. I'm sure we're going to laugh at a couple things that crop up, but like I had after this first one, I was like, yes.
Yeah. It's melodramatic Victorian style horror via Poe. I mean, it's sort of like so essential to horror. And I love melodrama. I love like fantasy stories that are like melodrama. I love horror stories that are like melodrama. When we get to the more sort of antiseptic and sort of darker, more straight-faced horror stories, I think I'll be like less happy, but we'll see.
Yeah. So with that, we're going to move to the second movie in this anthology based somewhat loosely around a couple of Poe stories.
Yeah, it combines a couple.
Interestingly, they combine the same ones that Maniac did back in the 1930s, which always makes me feel very bad when I have to credit Maniac for doing something interesting.
Well, yeah, first. It's the same
but
thing.
This,
So,
John, will you give us this overview of a story that combines the Black Cat and the Cask of Amontillado?
Yes. So, in this story, we first meet our lead character, who's Peter Lorre. The story is just titled The Black Cat. However, it's more almost the Cask of Amontillado than it is the Black Cat in the sense that the vengeance plot that takes place. Peter Lorre is a drunkard, an alcoholic. He walks around town trying to find free drinks, and when he can't do that, he goes home threatens his wife, smashes pots and pans, looking for money that he can take and go back out to the bar. His wife, Annabelle, so he is Montresor. His wife, Annabelle, is miserable. They have nothing left, and they have a black cat that he absolutely hates, and he knocks it off tables and curses at it. Well, one day, while he's out cavorting, he gets thrown out of a bar. He walks across a wine sellers, as in S-E-L-L-E-R-S, convention, and he claims he can taste wine better than anyone else. So he gets into a sort of taste-off with Vincent Price and wins. So now he's gotten all the wine he wants. Vincent Price takes him home, and wouldn't you know it, Vincent Price, who plays, hold on, let me get his name correct here.
Fortunato.
Who plays Fortunato, which is the name you'll recognize from the cask of Amontillado, falls in love with Annabelle. And what they do is they give Peter Lorre's character, Montresor, they give him cash so he can go drink, and the two of them hang out at home and cheat on him. He discovers this, and then he murders his wife, drugs Fortunato, and walls them up behind a wall of brick, just like in the story, eventually to be discovered by the police when the cat, who is also walled up, meows, and the police break down the wall and find their dead bodies.
This was, I know we said we were only going to take a couple minutes on each of these, but there is a lot in this like 25-minute bit.
It's the longest of the three, I think. It's right in the middle. Yes. I do want to hit on a couple of things. Do you want to go first?
I was just going to say this has the most incident in it. Like the first one and the third one are basically like a scene or two, but this one is more like a whole story. Yes. The only thing I was going to say is Peter Lorre is his performance.
He's so grumpy. Yeah.
It's the centerpiece of this thing, and just what a character, what an actor, like what a presence he has on the screen. I could just watch this guy all day.
You know what was a surprise to me, but I thoroughly enjoyed in this one? Vincent Price is funny.
Yes. Yes, he is.
He's hilarious. So he plays this sort of effete wine taster, and he goes through his ritual of tasting wine and like how he has this little, it's not even a glass. It's like this little tiny, saucer like thing that he sips the wine from, and he inhales it, and like I can't even do it. He does this whole ritual. It is hilarious, and it's almost like a Letterman joke where he like keeps doing it, like, and it gets funnier every time. So I guess I knew he was funny. I mean, here's the thing. When I saw him being funny, I saw him playing Egghead in Adam West Batman. He was hilarious, but I was 7, so I didn't know it was hilarious. I took it all very seriously. Whereas here, I can just see him hamming it up in the most delightful way.
And honestly, Price and Lorre play off each other so well in this bit, because one of the reasons that part really sings, where Vincent Price is doing this really comically detailed, you know, procedure of how he tastes wine, and he swishes it around and he makes goofy looking facial expressions as he tastes the wine.
Yes.
Meanwhile, on the other side of the table, Peter Lorre is just chugging glasses of wine in like one gulp. And they just play, the script has them playing off each other really well. So,
yeah, it's interesting. Peter Lorre's, so I'll tell you two things. Just I remember reading the cask of Amontillado, and I had a singularly terrifying thing that stuck with me from the first time I read it. But before that, Peter Lorre's character is so awful. He, like, at one point his wife says to him, he's like, "Where's our money?" And she's like, "We don't have any." He's like, "What are you talking about?" And she says, "Well, you haven't worked in 17 years." So he's just this horrible drunk who abuses his wife and his cat. And then when he's cheated on because he's horrible, he hatches this insane revenge plot, which he executes successfully. But here's the part that always terrified me about that story. In the original story, the character Fortunato, it's at a costume ball or on Halloween night, and he's dressed as a jester. So he has bells, jangling bells on his hat. After he gets walled in, he stops talking. Like, at first he pleads to be let out, and then he stops. And the last thing that Montresor can hear is just the faint jingling of the bells behind the wall, but no words.
Yeah.
And that's just burned in my brain as something absolutely terrifying. I can't tell you why.
Well, like, the genius of Peter Lorre's performance is that he's the worst person you've ever heard of. But you are also kind of on his side in a weird way throughout this, yes. because he's the likable, most likable, worst person you've ever heard of. So I have an audio clip just from sort of the climactic moment of this that I thought it's worth sharing, just so you can hear how Peter Lorre is doing this performance. This is as he's walling Fortunato into the cellar wall, they have this little exchange.
Don't make so much noise. I don't like it.
You're insane.
That may be, but very clever. The way I put that drug in your amontillado with a consummate skill of a Borgia. and this whole arrangement. They'll never find you behind this wall.
You can't mean it. You can't mean.
Haven't I convinced you of my sincerity yet? I'm genuinely dedicated to your destruction.
Like, it's just, and I guess this is probably Richard Matheson coming through here with the writing, but that's just fantastic.
Yeah.
So is there anything else you wanted to call out before we move on to our actual zombie story here?
Before the cops come and discover his crime, he has a nightmare where they emerge and they shoot it distorted so you can't see it in detail. And they cut off Peter Lorre's head and play ball with it while he watches in the dream. Yes. It's so cheesy and hilarious. So, yeah.
Yes. I was like 85% sure that was part of the movie and not like the video I was watching on YouTube getting horribly distorted
or
something. So, yeah. So, hey, the final of the three Poe stories in this anthology is the one that is really the reason that we are talking about this movie on Zombie Strains. This one is based on a Poe story called The Facts in the Case of M. Valdemar. And it, like the first one, is a pretty straightforward story. What we open with Vincent Price as the aging and dying Mr. Valdemar. He's surrounded by some people with him. He's in his last weeks or days of life. His daughter Helene is there. His doctor Elliot is there. But maybe more sinisterly, he has a hypnotist there. This is Dr. Carmichael, played by Basil Rathbone, in an incredibly sinister performance. Just a delightfully
like Ian Keith, he's almost impossible to believe as not a villain.
So Dr. Carmichael has been hypnotizing Valdemar to basically kind of free him from his pain as he draws to the end of his life. And the plan here is that Carmichael is going to hypnotize Valdemar. When Valdemar reaches the point of death, Carmichael is going to hypnotize him to, I guess, in theory, ease his passage into death, to make it painless, but also to see... to see how long the human spirit maybe might be kept around before passing on to death.
Can I sound like a tedious nerd for a second? I think they say mesmerized.
Please. Mesmerized. Thank you. And he's got a great, and well, we'll go through this one a little bit more detail than we have with the others. So, but the way it wraps up is that this indeed does happen. But what happens is when Valdemar is mesmerized on his deathbed, that prevents his soul from dying, basically. It traps his conscious spirit in his body, which has died, which is a horrifying and very zombie-related fate. Some various shenanigans happen, but it ends when Valdemar, after being kept in this state of torment for a long time, is prompted to... embody his corpse and rise from his bed and kill Dr. Carmichael to save his daughter from being assaulted by Carmichael, but also to give his spirit release.
Yeah, I think it's his wife.
I'm sorry. Yep. It's his wife. My bad. You're correct. So Helene is Valdemar's wife, who appears to be like 40 years.
By the way, it's the 1960s, and all three of these are filled with older men who date really attractive younger women. So
yes, these women are like 24 years old, and these men are like, okay. So why don't we go through this one in a little more detail? Jump in, John, as you see the need to. That said, we're going to go through this in more detail, but there also isn't a ton to the story beyond what I just told you. So as we open, so just remind me, is this the first zombie film where hypnotism or mesmerizing has been a feature or no? I think it is not.
I think it is not. There was a lot about hypnotism and mesmerism in... What was the one where they crash landed on the island?
King of the Zombies.
King of the Zombies. They now, I think in that one, the heroine was trying to use mesmerism to break her aunt out of her zombie hypnotic state.
That's right.
It's not exactly the same, but it has the same vibe, I guess I'd say.
Well, he was the scientist was also the bad guy was trying to use mesmerism to break into the mind of the admiral to get secrets.
That's right. Yeah.
That's right. Okay. Earlier in that, was there mesmerism in King of Revenge of the Zombies, or am I imagining that?
Revenge was after, Revolt was before.
What? Okay. All right. All right. Right. So anyway, so we have seen hypnotism and mesmerism before linked to, I guess, the fate of your soul in your body. But it's most dramatically done here because Carmichael has this big spinning light that is very cool, very cool and goofy looking.
Yeah, that was very goofy looking, and it detracted a little bit, but it was all also in the vein of just how delightful this whole thing is.
For sure. And so what we learned basically at the beginning is that in return for Carmichael periodically hypnotizing Voldemort so he kind of forgets his pain, the price he has agreed to pay is that he's going to let Carmichael hypnotize him on the verge of death. So nobody else likes this idea at all. And so here we have a little audio clip of that arrangement being described.
Mr. Voldemort has consented to be mesmerized in articulo mortis, which is to say...
At the point of death.
I fear it sounds more dreadful than it really is.
What does it mean? Ernest, why?
To ascertain, madam, just how long the actual moment of death can be forestalled. A momentous experiment.
Momentous? Monstrous would be more the word. Sir, I appeal to you. Withdraw this offer. The deathbed is no place for lunatic experiments.
My dear young friend, what can it matter whether I die 10 or 20 minutes beyond that point when I should die at any rate? What could be less important?
I have so much to say about this. Would you like to start?
No, you go dive right in.
So our Dr. Carmichael joins the list of people who... This happened in The Walking Dead starring Boris Karloff. Yes. The man who realizes he could use somebody who has died as a gateway to view the afterlife, though Carmichael does not say it here, that's his real intention. And I kind of love that.
Yes.
I can't remember when we talked about Boris Karloff's Walking Dead, if I talked about the story Revival by Stephen King, the book.
I don't know if we did, but go on.
Well, that book is focused on this similar plot. It's about a man who lost his wife and child in a car accident, and he is determined. He was a priest who lost his family, and he is determined to see what the afterlife looks like. So his life has been a long experiment to make this happen and to be with somebody at the moment of their death so that he can get a view into the other side. And I won't spoil it for you. It's probably the Stephen King book since 2010 with the most teeth at the end.
It is pitch black.
It is pitch. Yeah, it was one of those books at the end I was like, after reading it for like a month, I was like, why do anything? Why get up to, you know, like it was, it is dark. It's very good. I love this lineage of the doctor who wants a glimpse into the afterlife through the eyes of a dead person. And I just think it's so great.
Well, I know we talked when we were discussing The Walking Dead with Boris Karloff. I know it is a little curious that only in two films of the dozens we have watched have people expressed any curiosity as to what the zombie state might say about the afterlife or the human, like the human existence after death. Only in these two films has anyone thought, like, maybe we've brought these things back to life. Maybe they could tell us something. Maybe this has implications about our beliefs and our religion and things like that. That you would think that would be the first thing on your mind when right. a zombie came back is like, what have you seen? Where have you been? But hardly anyone asks this. And I do wonder, you know, most of these, I mean, zombies are different from ghosts and vampires and other creatures that, I guess, return from the dead.
Right.
In that they are often, and in most of the movies we've watched, you know, they are basically just animated corpses that maybe they still house some portion of the spirit of the person, the living person. Maybe they're just empty husks controlled by a zombie master, but they're hardly ever seen as like an existential being in the way that a ghost would.
Yes, exactly. And I think that's why this movie is so interesting, is that not only is he become an undead corpse, you know, that still has consciousness, but it's horrifying for him.
Yes.
You know, when it first happens, he's like, oh, the darkness, this is terrible. And what is, well, we're walking through, I don't want to spoil the end here, but.
Well, that's fine. I mean, there's really not much else in this. So let me just carry us through to the end and we can have the rest of this conversation, John. So some time goes by and the time has come. Death is near. Valdemar's lying in bed. He's basically saying, this is it. Go get Carmichael. It's time for him to mesmerize me because I'm about to die. Valdemar does that. And to their horror, the mesmerism causes Valdemar's spirit to keep living, and they can hear Valdemar's voice speaking. His lips don't move on the body anymore, but they can mentally hear it or something like that. So Valdemar's body dies, but his spirit is still there, and it's in torment.
And you can hear the torment. You can hear him scream, and you can hear what sound like, maybe I'm just reading this in, but like sound like the environs of hell when he talks.
It does. At one point, he's, you know, and Carmichael is asking him all these questions, like, what do you see? Because he's in this for the science and the knowledge, right?
Yeah, he wants knowledge of the afterlife.
Yeah, and at one point, you know, Valdemar describes what sounds an awful lot like hell. Like, I'm in darkness, there's a bunch of other people here, please release me. But Carmichael refuses, because why would you turn off this, you know, this spigot of information about the afterlife, right?
And it's horrible, and I am... You know, I just a weird connection. You and I are both fans of the Alien franchise and have watched Alien Earth.
Yeah.
There's a moment in the new Alien TV show where one of the synthetics can hear the alien's sort of stream of consciousness and duplicates the sound for the other humans out of her own mouth like a speaker. It's similarly terrifying in the same kind of way. Yeah.
So... long story short, this goes on for a while, and it's suggested that kind of Carmichael has sort of moved into this mansion, and he's kind of running the show. He's the only one who can free Valdemar from the mesmerism, because it was established that Valdemar would answer to no one other to his voice, and so Valdemar's just trapped in this living hell.
Or dying hell, as the case may be.
Yes, exactly. Helene and Elliot hate this. Helene... Well, I won't. They're in love with each other. I won't go into it. But let's hear an audio clip of Carmichael arguing with Elliot and Helene.
Yes, he is dead, but still aware.
Release him.
Release him? Valdemar, do you hear me?
I hear.
Tell me, where are you?
Stop it!
That will do, Mr. Carmichael.
Where, Valdemar? Where?
Stop it!
End the control. End the control, Mr. Carmichael.
No! Valdemar, tell me what you see. Your surroundings, what are they?
That will do, Mr. Carmichael!
No, are you insane? Do you not comprehend the import of what has happened? His body is dead, but his mind lives on, controlled by me.
Which control will now end? Let him die!
No!
Be gone!
So first thing I gotta say, I didn't mention it earlier, but we get some fantastic Scream Queen screams in these.
I was watching the movie on my laptop, and the cat was sitting on my lap during the first one, and the main character there let out a scream when she saw the tarantula, and like my cat jumped off my lap and ran across the room.
Yeah, there's a couple of really good screams. All of the actresses in this trilogy here get some good screams in.
And Vincent Price gets a good one in this as well, like in the last one. Yeah,
that's true. All right, so I'm just going to skip us here to the end, John, and then we can kind of share our wrap-up thoughts about this one. Time passes. Carmichael is still there. Elliot finally confronts Carmichael with a gun, and he's like, this has to end.
Sounds like a tough moral choice to me, by the way.
It does. Helene comes up and makes a tough moral choice. So throughout this, it has become clear that Carmichael is creeping on Helene. So she says, look, if you release my late husband, I will marry you if you release him from his torment. And then Carmichael goes full supervillain. He says, that's not how it's going to happen. You're going to marry me. You're going to marry me, like whether I release him or not. He begins to basically try to force himself on Helene. And as that is happening, Valdemar, whose corpse has started to kind of decay a little bit, is over on the bed, and it rises from the bed and lurches towards Carmichael. Helene faints. Carmichael, you know, cowers. And we, as Valdemar's corpse, and this is our movie's zombie, just to be clear, as it approaches, it starts decaying with these gruesome special effects that make it look like the flesh is melting off its bones. The camera is like kind of goes blurry doing this, so it's a little hard to get a fix on the special effect. I assume they're trying to hide the cheesiness of this.
Or maybe it's too scary, kind of like with the it could go either way. Like they did the same thing when they were tossing the head around in the Black Cat.
That's true too. It could also have been to tone down the gore maybe a little bit, but at any rate, we switch down to Elliot, who is kind of pacing around downstairs. You hear Carmichael scream. Elliot rushes up there. He bursts in and he finds Helene fainted on the ground, Carmichael dead on the ground, and on top of Carmichael is the gross,
rotting,
like rotted pile of gore that used to be Voldemort's corpse.
Oozing pile.
Oozing.
Yeah, it's super gross. And that's the end.
Yes.
So that's a wrap on
Tales of Terror. What was this one?
Tales of Terror and the facts in the case of M. Voldemort. So before we move on to where our closing questions are going to be focused only on this M. Voldemort episode. But before we do, what have we not touched on that we need to, Brad and John, about this one?
I mean, we've talked about it pretty thoroughly. I'm again struck. I mean, there's so many influential people here. One of them is Richard Matheson. One of them is Vincent Price, you know, but the other one is Edgar Allan Poe. You know, when I hear the facts in the case of M. Voldemort, I can't help but hear echoes to the case of Charles Dexter Ward by H.P. Lovecraft. Like,
totally. Yep.
Poe is like the OG horror writer and detective fiction writer, right? He wrote a lot of detective stories. Yep. Not all horror comes from Poe. That wouldn't be a true statement in the same way that not all fantasy comes from Tolkien or Robert E. Howard. But he's such a central point to melodramatic horror, which is such a big part of the American experience, because he also was an American author, you know, which, you know, wasn't a big thing at that time. You know what I mean?
Yeah. All right. Well, hey, let's go into our wrap-up questions, John. Some of these will be quick, we can fly through, but I sense some conversation coming up about a couple of them. So in the facts in the case of M. Voldemort, is there a hero party?
Sort of. I think his wife and Dr. Elliot are to the hero party. Yeah.
How do they do? How many survive?
They both survive, and the villain is killed.
What kind of zombie strain are we dealing with in this? And does it represent anything new?
I don't know what strain we're dealing with. He dies and is sort of trapped on Earth by mesmerism, but it's not quite the same as we did have mesmerized, hypnotized zombies. That's White Zombie, 1932, right? It's hypnotism and mesmerism. That is not what's happening here exactly. So I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, this is a little bit of the inverse of the zombie master relationship we've seen in other films. In this one, you know, the quote zombie master, Dr. Carmichael,
right,
is keeping the zombie inert. and the zombie retains enough will that it's able to overpower Carmichael's control briefly to murder Carmichael.
But before that, we don't think it's moved at all.
Right. So I don't, you know, I mean, this is a zombie. This is a zombie movie. That said, you know, this is based on a post story. It is not really trying to conform to the boundaries of the zombie genre as we've seen it so far. So right. This is a little bit of a unique instance. So you might call this, rather than a zombie, you might call this like a revenant,
yeah,
or something like in The Walking Dead with Boris Karloff. Yeah. Go ahead, Brad.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, the past mesmerisms were like Voodoo Man mesmerizing the living to control them.
Right.
And then there were, you would mesmerize the dead, but this is in between. Do you think this is a trapped soul zombie?
Sure.
That sounds good. Yeah.
Because most of the zombies, like modern zombies, they don't have essence of the person who was there before. So the soul has left.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'd agree.
He's dead. So therefore, the other ones are alive. So of course they have their soul in their person.
Yeah, that works.
I agree with that. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So I'm going to skip a few of these questions that obviously don't apply. Like, there's no zombie horde here.
Right.
How fast is this zombie, John?
It's a slow walker.
Yep.
Yep.
It really only catches you because you're so scared of it that you panic.
Right.
Don't do anything.
Yeah. At one point, Carmichael attempts to flee, but he's so panicked he drops the key and can't get out the door.
Yeah. John, are there any, aside from the specifics of the zombie itself, are there any new, like, zombie firsts we want to add to our list that we've been keeping in this film?
No, I don't think so, unless you've got one. This whole control of the zombie by holding its soul feels new to me. It's a different take on other films. I don't know.
Yeah, it. I agree. It doesn't feel like a brand new thing that's come out of nowhere, but it is. It just does. It does have a different feel than most of these films have had to date. So that's not a very articulate way of saying it. But why don't we see if we can get some clarity when we look at your four pillars of the zombie genre?
Sure.
So we'll fly through a couple of these. But is there an apocalypse in the facts in the case of M. Valdemar?
No. Nope. No apocalypse.
Is there contagion?
Nope.
Are there tough moral choices?
I think so. I think there's a couple right in a row. I think when Elliot is threatening to kill Carmichael to save his friend, that feels like a very zombie movie-esque tough moral choice.
It does.
And I think, you know, his wife saying she'll marry Carmichael is another one. So I think that's definitely here.
Yeah, and these feel like the sort of choices we were looking for in these, right?
Yeah.
He doesn't, I mean, by killing Carmichael, he might be dooming his friend to, you know, eternal horror.
But, right.
But what else are you going to do? Like, you really feel the, you really feel how backed he is into a corner here on what do you do about this?
How helpless he is.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And then Helene's choices, that's a good, you know, that was narratively satisfying moral choice, I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
Does this movie feature loved ones turning against you?
Well, what's interesting is the first story does in this, but not in M. Valdemar.
If anything, this is a loved one coming to your defense.
Yes, he turns on Carmichael, but I would say that Carmichael's just the villain. He doesn't know Carmichael's the villain when he agrees to this experiment.
Right, right.
But once he does, he turns on him. So I'd say probably not really.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I'd agree with that. All right. So, John, did you want to ask me any questions from our 1950s questions? I know we're a little ways into the 60s. Do you want to ask any of these?
Yeah, let's do a few. What about, like, paranoia as a major theme, or conformity, dark secrets?
So I'm going to say that dark secrets feels like it fits, at least for the first one, Morella. Well, I mean, so you have this really gothic, like, family that's, like, wealthy and successful, but it's just rotten on the inside due to this, like, this evil and these secrets that they have. Here, the dark side of this family is that, you know, the mother was cruel. I mean, she was beautiful, she was well-loved, but the people who knew her best and knew that she was cruel and angry.
Right.
The father hates the daughter. Like, that feels like a dark secret, dark family secret sort of thing to me.
Yes.
The rest of this, though, I don't see a lot of these themes in either in the second or the third ones.
No. And I think, like, for example, and a lot of these questions that we sort of designed for the 50s. So, for example, will science and sci-fi take on a new role? Not in this movie so much, right? Because it's Victorian.
Yeah. And I suspect we'll have to see when we discuss the 60s in more detail later. I suspect the 60s might see a pulling back from science
right.
and technology, just along in line with the turn towards melodrama.
Will the genre leave its local roots and moved on to the world stage?
No, I don't think so.
Yeah. No, I think so. I think this is a little bit of an outlier.
Yeah,
despite the fact that the zombie in question is fascinating and turns some of our expectations on its head. This is a branch of the zombie evolutionary tree that may be stopped shortly.
Agreed.
Yeah.
All right, so let me ask our last couple questions, John. Would you and I survive in the zombie world of The Facts and the Case of M. Valdemar?
I would, because I wouldn't let that creep hypnotize me.
Yep, same here. And it you really have to really, really, really mess with it to earn death at its hands. I mean, like,
right, yeah.
So,
yeah.
Is this a zombie movie or a movie with zombies, John?
It's a movie with a zombie.
Yeah, agreed. And do you recommend this movie, and let's expand this to be the whole Tales of Terror, this whole Roger Corman film. Do you recommend this movie first, generally, as a good movie that you should go watch, and secondly, specifically to the zombie-loving fans that listen to this podcast?
So I'm going to go with yes on as a general recommendation. It is schlocky, silly fun, and it's got huge melodrama. I mean, I love it. So, I think it's worth it. One, for example, I normally watch these movies, like, often in front of my computer where I'm furiously taking notes. And this one, I just tried a different approach. I was like, I'm just going to sit on the couch and watch it on the TV like it's a movie. Yeah. And then I took a few notes on my phone. I didn't have to worry about cues. And I just sat there and enjoyed the whole thing. So that's a yes for me. For zombie fans, I'm going to say no, not really. There's not really good or interesting zombie stuff here. I think it's definitely got a zombie in it, and I'm glad we talked about it, but I don't know that it's essential for zombie fans.
Yeah, those are my answers too. And yeah, I had a similar thought. So I unironically enjoyed this. I thought this was a good movie.
Yeah.
I won't recommend this to my parents or something, but if you like, you know, horror, especially if you like that Tales from the Crypt, like, kind of moralizing horror.
Yes, EC Comics, all that. This
is exactly that. This is my sweet spot. This is the kind of horror story I loved seeing on the screen when I was growing up. So this was a movie. A hot take here, but a lot of the movies we've watched, at least some point in the film, I've been like, oh gosh, this is a slog, but I've got to do this for the podcast.
Yeah.
This was one of a small number of films where I just enjoyed it from start to finish. So,
yeah.
That said, you know, it is a B movie schlock fest. So, you know, it's not Citizen Kane here. Don't get me wrong.
Correct.
Anyway. Yeah. So go watch it. But if you're here just for the zombies, no, you can skip it.
Yep.
All right, well, it's time for the scariest part of the episode, where we learn what producer Brad has in store for us next. So, Brad, what will we be watching for the next episode?
We are staying in 1962.
Okay.
And here is the poster for our next movie.
Oh.
Oh, what is this? Carnival of Souls. We want to describe this poster, Andy?
Well, so first of all, this is a movie that was mentioned when I was reading up on the turn towards melodrama and gothic horror.
Oh,
this is one of the ones cited as a significant movie in that vein. So this is a pretty stylized poster in black and white. It says there's a lettering up at the top that says, "A story so unusual, it will burn itself into your mind." And then maybe it's like they had three good ideas, and instead of pick the best, they're like, put all these slogans on the film. So we have another tagline that says, "A weird tale of the unnatural." And then lastly, it says, "A picture that will haunt you." And the picture described, we see a startled looking woman in a white dress that's coming off of her shoulders in front of what looks like those look like minarets almost. Is that supposed to be?
Seems like somebody dancing in the background or something.
Yeah, it could be.
Yeah.
Is that guy in the bottom left, is he supposed to be sinister?
He looks sinister to me. Looks sinister.
And then there's a woman in a car. So what do you think about this poster,
John? Well, not just a woman in a car. What's happening to her?
She's drowning.
The car is sinking.
Yeah, oh, okay. I didn't know that was supposed to be water, but yes.
So it looks like a lithograph or a pencil drawing. There's no realistic or photographic elements in it at all. So I don't know. I'm very curious about this film. I've never heard of it before. And it's produced and directed by somebody I've never heard of either. So I'm intrigued. I know nothing about this film, but I will in approximately one episode's time.
You'll know more about it than you ever.
That is correct.
Dreamed you would in your worst nightmares.
You know what? I'm going to go positive here and be like, this is that I would bet a couple bucks. This is a sleeper that is genuinely good in the same way I Walked with a Zombie was genuinely good. So
Brad, clip that audio so that it can be used to hoist John by his own petard in the next episode.
Fair enough.
All right. This looks great. Thanks, Brad.
All right. Thanks, everybody. We will see you next episode on Zombie Strains. You've been listening to Zombie Strains. We'll be back next episode to talk about another zombie movie. If you enjoyed our podcast, please take a moment to rate us in your podcast app of choice. Tell a friend. Follow us on Instagram at Zombie Strains. All of this helps like-minded people find the show. See you next time.